Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who examines the environmental conflicts in Honduras that led to the March 3rd assassination of indigenous rights leader Berta Cáceres. Gretchen Borschelt of the National Women's Law Center, who discusses what's at stake for reproductive rights in a case challenging a Texas abortion law recently heard before the U.S. Supreme Court. And Michael Winston, former executive at Countrywide Financial and co-founder of Bank Whistleblowers United, who talks about his group's plan to challenge presidential candidates to forswear dirty Wall Street money. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon angered human rights monitors when he cited the international organization's legal immunity in rejecting compensation claims by thousands of cholera victims in Haiti. A class action lawsuit is pending against the UN, filed by the Boston-based Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti on behalf of 5,000 Haitian cholera victims. The lawsuit calls for the UN to install a national water and sanitation system, pay compensation to the victims, and make a public apology for wrongful acts. Thus far, Ban Ki-moon has refused to take responsibility for the 2010 cholera outbreak that has been linked to poor sanitation among UN peacekeepers from Nepal. According to the Guardian newspaper, over 9,000 Haitians died in the cholera outbreak, and 750,000 others were treated for the disease. Five United Nations human rights rapporteurs blasted the Secretary General, asserting that Ban Ki-moon's claim of immunity undermines the reputation of the UN and calls into question the ethical framework within which the peacekeepers operate. Millions of Americans went to the polls on Super Tuesday to pick their party's candidates to run for president. But 6 million ex-offenders have lost their voting rights, including 2 million African Americans. The loss of voting rights for African Americans and the rapid expansion of mass incarceration has been dubbed the new Jim Crow. According to the American Prospect, voting rights for ex-offenders have been restored in some states in recent years. Although Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe relaxed some voting restoration rules, ex-felons who committed violent crimes must wait 3 years after their release to regain their voting rights. Laws are much tougher in Tennessee, where anyone convicted of certain violent or sexual crimes is permanently banned from voting. Voting restrictions for ex-offenders were also relaxed in Wyoming, where the Department of Corrections must now issue a certificate of voting rights to first-time nonviolent offenders after their release from prison. Prior to this change, first-time nonviolent offenders in Wyoming could only apply to have their voting rights restored 5 years after completing parole and probation supervision. The movement to end disenfranchisement has a broad base of support from criminal justice reform advocates and voting rights advocates alike. Both argue that denial of the right to vote is detrimental to the process of reintegrating newly released offenders into civil society. Before the arrest of serial rapist and murderer Anthony Sowell, Cleveland hospitals often let victims of sexual violence wait for hours for a rape examination. At the time, few hospital staff were trained in medical and forensic rape examinations. 2 months after Sowell's arrest, Cleveland Mayor Frank Jackson formed the Special Commission on Missing Persons and Sex Crimes Investigation. The commission's report, issued on May 30, 2010, proposed 26 recommendations for handling these issues differently, including adding a countywide missing persons bureau. Soon afterwards, the Cleveland Police Department revived the Sex Crimes and Special Victims Units and built stronger ties with advocates for rape victims. Police Captain James McPike, who runs the Special Victims Unit, told the Christian Science Monitor, "We take a more victim-centered approach because they deserve to be treated with empathy and compassion." As they've learned more about sexual crimes and how to deal with them, Cleveland officials are increasingly being asked to speak across the country. Richard Bell, Assistant County Prosecutor, says, "We're trying to help other jurisdictions learn from our mistakes." Noting the similarities in other cities where rape kits weren't tested or not enough detectives were assigned to cases, so that rape investigations were regularly shut down when they should have been kept open. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The Central American nation of Honduras is well known for having one of the highest murder rates in the world. That includes violence attributed to narco-trafficking, gang conflicts, and street crime. But Honduras is also the most dangerous country for environmentalists, where 116 eco-activists were killed in 2014, many of them defending indigenous communities and lands. The March 3rd murder of Berta Cáceres, winner of the 2015 Goldman Environmental Prize, is the latest tragic news from Honduras. Cáceres, who was shot by two unknown assailants who broke into her home, led the Council of Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, or COPIN, that actively opposed the construction of a proposed dam on the Gualcarque River, an area considered sacred by the Lenca people. She had previously reported receiving numerous death threats from police, soldiers, and local landowners because of her work. The escalating violence in the country is linked by many observers to the 2009 coup that ousted the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya. The government, which came to power after Zelaya's overthrow with U.S. support, has since pushed to build a controversial network of dams and mining projects on indigenous land. Your reporter spoke with Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who talks about the environmental conflicts in Honduras that likely led to the assassination of Berta Cáceres and the U.S. role in the 2009 Honduras coup, which occurred when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State.
This is the single most important political assassination since the coup. And the fact that they killed Berta Cáceres is a sign that now anyone could be killed. They have not gone for the top leadership of the social movements up till now. Berta was this amazing, amazing activist, one of the most alive and loving and fun people I've ever met in my life. And there has been this long, long struggle to try to stop this dam, which is going forward, even though the rights of indigenous people to be consulted have been violated. There's been tremendous protests against the dam, peaceful protests, and tremendous repression of the Lenca people and other activists for trying to stop it. And Berta has been in the forefront of that. She was threatened for many years. Their state security forces have threatened and repressed the Lenca people. Another Lenca activist, Tomas Garcia, was shot dead by the military in the summer of 2013, and his son also shot. And Berta had been receiving death threats and threats for years, but especially in the last 2 weeks, on February 20th, there was a peaceful march to the site of the dam, and there was repression, including by U.S.-funded special forces Tigres, that the very close to the U.S. embassy, and people were forced to walk back in the dark 7 hours to get to their bus. Very, very dangerous situation. The Honduran government itself attacks Berta verbally and for her activism for many years. So we all knew this was going to happen. She knew it was going to happen. And this is a message to the social movements of the indigenous people, environmental movement, the opposition. Berta was a very one of what I think of as the seven or eight, the goddesses of the Honduran resistance, who is so important in terms of the resistance to the 2009 military coup that deposed democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya.
Dana Frank, do we know who is responsible for Berta's murder?
Well, there's like who actually shot the gun versus who's responsible for it at the broad level. We don't know who the two gunmen were. There is an eyewitness who was also shot and wounded, Gustavo Carrillo Soto, who is being held against his will by the Honduran government. He was also shot. He was held. He's still being detained within the country. And he was held without food and water, even though he was covered in his bloody clothes and had been wounded. And he has already testified to outsiders in a letter that he saw evidence being destroyed. So, you know, first of all, we have to understand that there's to even find out what happened, there's already a cover-up and destruction of evidence going on. So we don't know who actually fired the shots. We do know that the Honduran government wasn't providing her with adequate protection as mandated by the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. We know that this is a government that ignored threats. We know that the U.S. Embassy didn't stop do things they should have done to stop the threats. We know that this is a government that has repeatedly attacked her and Copin, that this is a government that's now trying to criminalize the members of Copin, her organization, and act like they committed the crime. They have a cover-up already, and even saying things like it was a crime of passion, which is, of course, preposterous in this context. So who's responsible? How about the top of the Honduran government, which has been attacking these folks, been attacking them with state security forces, and the U.S. government for funding those security forces over and over again, and even increasing them in recent years, despite all this documented evidence. So who's responsible? It goes way back, and it goes way high.
As many of our listeners are aware, there was a military coup in Honduras in 2009, in the first year of the Obama administration. Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State at the time. And Dana, I would ask you to tell our listeners what's important for Americans to know about the role of the United States in our policies toward Honduras during the time of the coup and after the coup.
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, people need to know that the U.S., while we don't have the smoking gun showing that they prompted the coup, immediately treated the post-coup de facto dictator president, Roberto Micheletti, as a legitimate president. They equated him with the deposed president and established negotiations where they treated them as equals. It never denounced the spectacular post-coup repression of the huge opposition that rose up. Now, Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State during that period, and you can read her emails. You can see her statements on the public record of how she treated Zelaya like a bad child for trying to return to his own country, of which he was the democratically elected president. And so I think people need to know this about Hillary Clinton. And they also need to understand that it was Obama who allowed her to do that. And it's Obama who's in charge right now, whose budget request for 2016, and which much of it which has passed, was hundreds of millions of dollars for the Honduran government, including its state security forces, and is now just putting in his budget request for 2017, increasing that even more, despite the spectacular corruption of the police and military. And, you know, we're not hearing that demand to suspend the aid, although there have been letters from up to 90 members of Congress in the last few years saying that all police and military aid should be suspended, which is what we should be asking for right now.
That was Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Learn more about the environmental conflicts in Honduras and the life and struggles of indigenous leader Berta Cáceres by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Texas law passed in 2013 that has severely restricted women's access to abortion was appealed and reached the Supreme Court this term, where both sides argued their case on March 2nd. The law required doctors performing abortions to be given admitting privileges at local hospitals, while also requiring abortion clinics to meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers. Similar legislation has passed in many other states. Supporters of these laws maintain that they were implemented to protect women's health. But women's health providers and advocates say such laws have had the opposite effect by denying women constitutionally protected health care. The High Court's ruling in the Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt case could come any time up through the end of the court's term this June. In 2012, Texas had 41 abortion clinics open, serving most of the state. Now Texas has only 19 operating clinics, and that number would be reduced to 9 if the restrictive abortion law being challenged takes effect. By implementing the so-called targeted regulation of abortion providers, or TRAP laws, Republican governors and legislatures across the U.S. have succeeded in eroding abortion rights over the past several years. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Gretchen Borschelt, Vice President for Reproductive Rights and Health at the National Women's Law Center. Here she explains why this case is considered the most important for reproductive health in a generation, and what ruling she expects from the Supreme Court after it lost its most conservative member, Antonin Scalia, who died in February.
The question that's at issue in this case that's before the court right now, is how far states can go in their attempts to make it difficult or even impossible for women to exercise their constitutional right to abortion. Now, we know that for over 40 years, the Supreme Court has made it clear that women have a constitutionally protected right to decide whether to entertain an abortion. And the last major case on that decision was in 1992, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, and the Supreme Court said states can't pass laws that impose an undue burden on that right. Since that decision in 1992, we've seen state lawmakers try to make an end run around those protections and advance laws that are really designed to shut down clinics and make it impossible for women to get the essential reproductive health care they need. And that's what's at stake here. What does that standard that the court put into place in 1992, the undue burden, what does that mean for women? What constitutes an undue burden? This is really the court's first major wrestling with that question since it set the standard into place.
The Supreme Court just issued a stay against the enforcement of a similar law in Louisiana, which would have reduced the number of abortion facilities in the state from 4 to just 1. I guess that's at least a temporary victory for women.
So in Louisiana, they passed a requirement for admitting privileges, which is one of the restrictions at issue in the Texas case. And the Supreme Court stepped in to hold that law so that it doesn't go into effect. So it's certainly a victory for women in Louisiana who won't be left with just one clinic in the entire state. It doesn't tell us much about the way they'll come out in Texas necessarily, because those kinds of stay orders don't have an entire written decision. You don't really know what the justices are thinking. But, you know, I think it shows that these kinds of restrictions are passing across the country. It's not just in Texas. These kinds of restrictions are passing, and we really need the Supreme Court to step in here and put an end to it.
Gretchen Borschelt, we talked about this a couple of years ago when the Texas law was first passed. The biggest difference now is that there are 8 members on the Supreme Court instead of 9. Justice Antonin Scalia, who died recently, would clearly have been on the side of the Texas law in further restricting abortion rights. So now with Justice Anthony Kennedy always seeming to be the swing vote, it looks like it will either be a 4-4 tie or the justices will come down against the Texas law. Can you elaborate on those two scenarios? What would it mean for women?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I want to say we're confident that the Supreme Court is going to strike down these laws. It has long been the case that the Supreme Court has affirmed that the U.S. Constitution protects a woman's right to abortion, and there's this undue burden standard. And given what is happening with Texas, with all of these clinics shutting down, women being forced to travel 500 miles to get an abortion, not being able to access abortion at all, then it's clear that this is an undue burden. So we're confident in a 5-3 decision, even with the absence of Justice Scalia. I think that we have a victory here. If the court were to tie with a 4-4 decision, that would mean that the lower court's decision would stand, which in Texas is a terrible decision. And the clinics would close. Women would lose their ability to access abortion in this country. I don't think that that's a result that the court can really approve of. And it also would just mean that these other cases that are pending, like in Louisiana, like in Mississippi, would still be working their way up to the court. And the court is going to have to resolve this question once and for all eventually.
I was looking at data from the Guttmacher Institute about abortion trends. From 1973 to 2011, which was the most recent year for data, abortions hit a high of 1.6 million nationally in 1988, and there's been a significant drop between 2008 and 2011, which the Institute attributes to what it calls a steep drop in unintended pregnancy, which in turn is most plausibly explained by more and better contraceptive use, and not to all the anti-abortion laws being passed, which mostly went into effect after 2011. But access to birth control is also under assault, isn't it?
This isn't the only case about reproductive health that's before the court this term. There's another case that the Supreme Court is reviewing about access to a birth control and whether employers can step in and prevent women from accessing birth control. So, you know, we're seeing these kinds of efforts to interfere in a woman's decision-making, whether it's abortion, whether it's birth control, by third parties who should not be involved. You know, politicians shouldn't have a role in deciding whether women can access abortion, and your boss shouldn't have a role in deciding whether or not you use birth control. So, again, we're confident that the Supreme Court's going to step forward in both these cases and put an end to this interference in women's decision-making.
That was Gretchen Borschelt of the National Women's Law Center. Learn more about the Texas anti-abortion law and the groups working to protect women's reproductive rights by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Michael Winston had a successful career as an executive at five Fortune 100 corporations over 30 years. Most recently, when he was employed as a high-ranking executive at Countrywide Financial, he tried to stop the fraud, corruption, and deception he observed at the mortgage lender in advance of the worldwide 2008 financial collapse. His warnings were dismissed or ignored by management, and he was eventually fired. Winston subsequently took Countrywide and Bank of America to court, winning what the trial judge called an overwhelming jury verdict. Though the verdict was later overturned by an appeals court, Winston's legal fight was profiled in a Salon magazine article titled, "Wall Street's Greatest Enemy, the Man Who Knows Too Much." Now Winston, along with three other prominent eyewitnesses to high-level wrongdoing by the nation's largest financial institutions in the federal government, have founded a new group they call Bank Whistleblowers United. The four men have proposed a detailed plan to restore the rule of law to Wall Street and too-big-to-fail banks and restore the best features of the Glass-Steagall Act that used to govern bank activities. In this election year, they intend to challenge presidential candidates to make a pledge forswearing campaign contributions from the banks and executives who engaged in fraudulent behavior that triggered the 2008 financial meltdown. Your reporter spoke with Michael Winston, who describes his journey from high-level executive to whistleblower and the goals of his group's campaign to expose the links between the corrupting influence of Wall Street's dirty money and U.S. politics.
Each of the four of us, Gary Aguirre, Bill Black, Dick Bowen, and myself, saw corruption up close, personal, unmistakable, and we tried to do something about it. And the irony is, we blew the whistle. None of us, by the way, knew we were blowing the whistle when we blew it. We just thought we were doing our jobs, which was telling management what they were doing that was unlawful. And we connected just because of shared frustration with the use of the word, any round word except fraud, whether it's the people who did this were either reckless or had loose standards or were greedy. No, they were committing fraud. And all of us saw it, and all of us tried to do something about it. I took my company, Countrywide Financial, and then Bank of America to court, and I won an overwhelming jury verdict. By the way, all of us won, and somehow it was lost a couple of years later with no new evidence and just the unmistakable stench of graft, corruption, backroom deals, and payoff. And we see that nothing has really changed in the 8 years. Nothing put in place to protect a recurrence of the same securities violations, securities fraud, and just foul business practices that led to the greatest unpunished white-collar crime in history.
Tell our listeners what your group, Whistleblowers United, will be doing this election season and your goals in confronting presidential candidates with the pledge you're asking them to sign.
Well, number one, every single person running for office has indicated their distaste for what went on in Wall Street and their determination to thwart the recurrence of it. We're simply asking these same people who say they are committed to eradicating graft and corruption and fraud, we're asking them to simply not take campaign donations from those companies or those executives who committed that fraud. Seems pretty simple to us. If you are running for high office and you say you speak heavily of your disdain for those practices, why would you accept money from those people? But we're going further. We submitted a 20-point plan to restore the rule of law across the country and on Wall Street in particular. Because what we've seen is that the white-collar criminals have not been punished at all, but those people who surface their criminality, called whistleblowers, have been punished in every conceivable ways and many inconceivable ways. So we want to fix it so that it doesn't happen again and again and again.
Well, Michael, in your view, what legislation needs to be put in place, or what kinds of enforcement needs to be beefed up to avoid a repeat of the financial calamity this country and the world went through in 2008?
Yeah, I don't think any new legislation, I don't think any new laws. I think we need to enforce the laws that are on the books. And I think the people who committed fraud, systemic, blatant, in-your-face fraud, ought to be punished for it. What we know is that if people are rewarded for something, they'll do it again. If they're punished for it, they're likely to stop doing it. Well, all the architects of the 2007 and 2008 fraud have been essentially rewarded. They got to keep the money they heisted, and none of them did jail time. So it's likely the next generation or that generation is planning their next scheme. Obviously, forewarned is forearmed, but these are very smart people. I mean, look at The Big Short. And, you know, we want to inform and alert those who commit that we're going to be watching them and that others are going to be better educated in watching them so that it doesn't happen again. Yeah, I think of all the legislation and the regulations that were introduced, almost every one of them was gutted to such an extent that it is barely recognizable. Most people in financial services are honest, upstanding, try to do the right thing. So I'm talking about maybe a tenth of 1%. But those people who are intent on committing fraud and doing harm to the economy are going to do it, and they're plotting their moves right now as we speak.
That was Michael Winston, a former high-ranking executive at Countrywide Financial and a co-founder of the group Bank Whistleblowers United. Learn more about the Whistleblowers Group by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.